This episode of The Fifth Kind is brought to you by Ancient Knowledge Academy, a learning community for anyone interested in human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today. G'day and welcome to Ancient Knowledge Academy, and we're here in the first class in a course on recovering from fundamentalism, reframing faith. Now, you might not be personally recovering from fundamentalism, but if you've been involved in the world of Christianity or religion, you may find you have to reframe a lot of old ideas if you are on a quest for truth or a research path into topics that touch upon our ancient history and our place in the cosmos. If you have any Christianity in your background, you may know the verse I'm about to quote. Trust in Yahweh with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways defer to Him, and He will direct your paths. Now, you may know a different translation of that. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, in all your ways acknowledge Him. And it was very often quoted as the bedrock of humble Christian spirituality. Lean not on your own understanding. Trust in Yahweh with all your heart. What does it mean not to lean on your own understanding? It means not to think for yourself. It means not to trust your own mind if a religious authority is telling you something else. But it took me a long time to realize that this verse trotted out as a bedrock of humility and spirituality was, in fact, a device in a web of thought control used by institutional Christianity through the generations to empower those who teach and disempower the flock. So the reason I mention that is because that in my coaching space, I have found in recent years that a lot of people have really struggled to give themselves permission to look at the kind of things we do at Ancient Knowledge Academy or the things I've written about in the Eden series without the terrifying fear lurking in the wings that if they believe the wrong thing, they're going to go to hell. That if they believe the wrong thing, they are going to be tortured in perpetuity by an implacable God who will not have mercy after you've died. Now, if you have had that kind of religion in your background, it can be quite difficult to shake it off. But the purpose of this unit is to tell you that it is totally ill-founded, that the doctrine of hell or eternal conscious torment or eternal punishment is built on a foundation of sand. Until you can shake off this background fear, you do not have the freedom to explore. How can you possibly have the creative freedom to explore possibilities if the prospects of getting it wrong mean that you're going to be tortured forever? You will not give yourself that freedom. So you have to shake off the doctrine of hell and its legacy if you're going to have a happy intellectual journey. So that's the purpose of this unit. I'll share some thoughts on it. I'm going to read you a chapter from one of my books that treats upon the topic. And then you and I are going to have a conversation, because this is something you really need to wrestle with other people to convince yourself of a better way forward. So let me begin by telling you a story. Years ago, I had a friend who was the senior theologian for a major Christian cult in Great Britain. He was the principal of its theological college, and he'd been involved in that movement for many, many years. He and his wife and his children were all part of this movement. And indeed, in this Christian cult, your whole family does have to be involved in it. I won't name it, because that's not really the point. You can probably work out which one I'm talking about. Well, through his studies of their translation of the Bible, he came to the conclusion that one of the movement's central doctrines could not be supported from the Bible. And the doctrine he had a particular problem with was the one that said anyone not in their organization would be going to hell. And even on the basis of their own translation, he could see this was insupportable. This was built on a foundation of sand. And he started sounding out other members of the faculty to see what they thought. And they said to him, I'll give him a fake name. They said, Theo, we worked this out years ago, but please don't breathe a word of this to the higher-ups. If you tell the higher-ups this is what you're thinking, you'll be out, you'll be shunned, you'll be cut off from the movement, you'll be cut off from your family. And they were right. He did breathe a word of it to the leadership, and to his horror, they weren't at all concerned that on the basis of his erudite study as their leading theologian, that they might be wrong on the doctrinal point. Their concern was if they conceded that, they would have no purchase over the people in their movement anymore. People would have no reason to stay within the movement if there was no hell for leaving. And so they threw him out. He was shunned, which did indeed mean he could never see his wife and children again. And he moved to the other end of the country to begin rebuilding his life. Now, ironically, if that's the right word, he found a church to go to, which was one of the largest churches in Europe. Major, major Pentecostal church. And I happened to know the senior pastor there. I was friends with the principal of its Bible college, and I had sounded him out in a similar way. And I'd say, I'll make up a name for him. Nigel, I said, I've come to the conclusion that the doctrine of hell as eternal conscious torment for the non-believer cannot be supported from the Bible. It's not there in the Gospels and New Testament when you read them closely. And he said, yes, yes, he said, just don't mention that to our senior pastor here. It's not that he doesn't agree with you, but he believes that if we concede that point, no one will come to church anymore, because why would they? It was the same story. And unfortunately, my friend from the Christian cult had landed in exactly that church. Same dynamic in its leadership, same falsehood on which its social control was being built. See the problem? I found it myself when I was working for a Pentecostal denomination in the UK. Through my own study of the New Testament, I had come to the conclusion hell as eternal conscious torment was an invention. In fact, the popular notion of hell as a place of eternal fiery punishment into which the non-believer is thrown to be tormented along with the devil and all his minions, you won't really find that doctrine until the medieval period. And I came to that conclusion quite quickly when I went to theological college as a young person and read through the scriptures for myself. And so when years later I was considering taking status with this Pentecostal denomination, I found to my horror that to do that I had to agree to that doctrine in its doctrinal statement. So I mentioned this to our regional superintendent, and he said, why don't you talk to our lead theologian, the pastor of the seminary? He'll be able to talk you through this. So I did indeed. I called him up. We had a long conversation about it. And he said, Paul, I think you're right. Unfortunately, a generation of our leaders will have to die before we can go back to the doctrinal basis and update it. These are the social dynamics of communities of faith. And so this is how you can have whole denominations preaching a totally abusive, socially controlling, psychologically manipulative doctrine, knowing it to be false, because they're just waiting for a generation of leaders to expire before they can review it. Now, I don't meet many people who do believe in hell, but I do meet a lot of people in the coaching space who are anxious about their theological or intellectual journey. They have to get it right. They have to nail every detail down. And that anxiety is there because it's been drilled into them from a young age that if they believe the wrong thing, the consequences are worse than life and death. And this is why you have to shake this background doctrine off altogether. If you're to have the freedom to say, well, I don't know, I'm exploring this. That may be true, this may also be true. To have that freedom, we have to put this doctrine to bed. So I'm going to read to you a chapter from my book, The Eden Conspiracy. I give a whole chapter to this question, which I want to share with you. And then at the end, I'm going to put a question forward for us to tackle in the thread, and then we'll have a live conversation about it, because it does take a little bit of to and fro, a little bit of wrestling to shake yourself free from this idea. So I'm going to read now from The Eden Conspiracy. Chapter 11, Into the Unknown, Burwood, Sydney, New South Wales, 2015. Our guest today is one of the best-known, most respected evangelical preachers of our time. For 30 years, he held the pulpit of one of the world's most renowned preaching centres, held in previous tenures by some of the greatest names in the world of evangelical Christianity. We are most fortunate to have him grace our little gathering of pastors here today, half a world away. We are indeed very fortunate. My friend Pastor Lance has achieved a great coup in getting the Reverend Dr. Darrell Keswick to fly halfway around the world to sit with this small gathering of pastors from across the various denominations in the state capital of Sydney. Lance and I both have great affection for the Reverend Doctor going way back, even if in the years since our spiritual explorations have taken us in rather different directions. I think it would be fair to say that Lance has modelled a lot of his preaching style on that of the Reverend Doctor. Early in my career as a priest, I too enjoyed a season of sitting at Darrell's feet, listening to him expound on the scriptures. Darrell was and is a great orator, and I was positively enriched by the experience of watching him in action. However, before long, I realised that there was one aspect of his teaching that I felt uncomfortable with. Darrell preached hellfire. And by hellfire, Darrell meant eternal conscious torment. In Darrell's theology, the punishment for not becoming a Christian would be that after your death, God would resurrect you, body, spirit, and soul, and then set you on fire. Only the agony of being on fire would continue for eternity. This is the classic hellfire teaching of Orthodox Christianity. I had a problem with this on two counts. Firstly, it is so obviously cruel and unjust. To mete out an infinite punishment for a finite crime is mathematically absurd. The idea that I had a problem with this because I was somehow more compassionate than God was equally absurd. So something in this overall picture had to be off. My second problem was that it is not the teaching of the Bible. I went to theological college as a relatively new convert from atheism to Christianity. In my first few years as a believer, I'd found the church's arguments for hell as eternal conscious torment to be very unsatisfactory, and I resolved that a personal goal for my 3 years of theological training at Nottingham University and St. John's College was to reread the entire New Testament, scouring it for its teachings about the afterlife, to see whether those texts really did teach eternal conscious torment, or if there was another way they could be understood. I soon found that the great majority of texts could be read in more than one way, and that the plain reading of the majority gave a meaning to do with destruction or ruin. I quickly saw that Jesus' warnings about ultimate consequences actually have to do with a place called Gehenna. Gehenna was the trash heap just beyond the city walls of Jerusalem. Clearly, Jesus was speaking figuratively. He was not literally warning people about the municipal trash heap. Rather, Jesus was warning his hearers about selfish, destructive, and self-destructive behaviours which have the potential to unravel and ruin your life, and land you on the trash heap of life, full of regret and remorse. When not invoking Jesus' vocabulary around Gehenna, the authors used other words to indicate the worst possible outcome. They are words which describe being destroyed, ruined, or undone. As I continued my fine-tooth journey through the scriptures, I found only two texts whose plain meaning suggested eternal conscious torment. One is a highly metaphorical text in Revelation, full of grotesque symbology, threatening those who worship the beast and his image with a perpetually ready funeral pyre. The threat concludes with the phrase, "And the smoke of their torment goes up for ever and ever, and they have no rest day and night." The second find was in the Apocrypha, a text in the book of Judith, threatening God's enemies with a perpetually ready fire and a perpetually ready worm to eat their putrefying remains. This is graphic language in an apocryphal book aimed essentially at taunting foreigners and infidels. The language is emphatically figurative. To my mind, these two isolated metaphorical texts do not amount to a strong platform for 2,000 years' worth of dogma. Darrell was an enthusiast for the traditional dogma. So one day, in a spirit of humble inquiry, I laid out all the information I just shared with you, but footnoted with all the textual references and carefully listing the uses of the key words concerned. I put my findings to him and asked, in the light of these texts, how he had arrived at the conclusions he had championed on an international scale in his books, conferences, and guest appearances. Was the Reverend Doctor reading the traditional doctrine into the texts? Or was I mistaken? Were there in reality more than two texts in which the traditional church doctrine could be found without any ambiguity? Was I wrong in my estimation of the openness of the majority of the texts? To give Darrell credit, he answered that he had not really considered the other possible readings of the majority of the relevant texts, those where more than one meaning can easily be seen. It was something that he hadn't thought to do, since he found no conflict between them and the belief he already held. Did it matter that those verses could also support other views? However, now that I was pressing him, and now that he realized that he couldn't justify his own interpretations over and against other readings of the texts, Darrell told me that he would need to take a little time to revisit the texts. He would also consult with a more academic friend who happened to be in the process of writing his PhD thesis on the very topic of our conversation. He promised that once he had compared notes with his academic friend, he would be able to get back to me and explain why he had always favoured the traditional doctrine of eternal conscious torment. At the time, I was quietly impressed with Darrell's honesty in admitting that he hadn't even considered alternative interpretations of the vast majority of relevant texts. I respected him for conceding that he needed to put more thought to it before replying, and I was more than happy to allow him a little time for the sake of a more developed answer. 22 years later, I was thrilled to have the opportunity of a follow-up conversation with Darrell while he was visiting Australia. I began by assuring him of my sincere appreciation of his amazing pulpit ministry in my early years. When I asked him how his thinking had progressed on the question of hell since our earlier discussion, this is what he said. "I have now concluded that you will not find the doctrine of hell as eternal conscious torment in the New Testament unless you already hold that belief a priori before you read all the texts. If you go to the New Testament with a blank slate, you will come away believing that Jesus warned not of hell, but of destruction. But you won't find hell in the Bible unless you already hold that belief. And I hold that belief, always have, and nothing and no one will convince me otherwise." I was open-mouthed. On the one hand, I was struck by the Reverend Doctor's startling honesty, while on the other hand, I was simultaneously horrified that he would continue to preach so defiantly on a doctrine that he now admitted he couldn't defend. This lack of a biblical foundation for such a strong and persistent teaching in the church is the reason why the late great Reverend Dr. John Stott, a pillar of British evangelical Christianity, considered hell to be a doctrine that had not been tested against the plumb line of the Gospels and New Testament. Courageously, he put this view forward publicly in his 1988 book, Evangelical Essentials. Destruction and hell are not the same thing. Ruin and regret are not the same as a lake of fire or an eternity of conscious torment. Back in the late 1980s, I quietly applauded Dr. Stott from the sidelines as he tentatively indicated these rather obvious points. Unfortunately, despite his unblemished record of decades of orthodox teaching, John Stott quickly found himself pilloried and vilified by fervent evangelical believers all around the world. I certainly know what that feels like. In fact, he was pressured to such an extent that he finally had to retract his tentative criticisms of the hell dogma and back away from suggesting that it ought to be tested against the writings of the Gospels and New Testament. Such is the popular zeal for the doctrine among so many Christian believers around the world. It is a zeal which peppers my inbox unfailingly every week and some weeks every day. As I respond to the comments on my videos and documentaries on the Fifth Kind and the Paul Wallace Channel, the graphic threats and hopes of violence to be meted out against me personally by God provide me with an object lesson in what happens when we confuse the idea of God with a destroyer or a dragon or some other dark and violent entity. It isn't pretty. It is only logical. If, in our imagination, we worship a God who exacts violence and genocide, then in our minds we have to justify violence and genocide and call it praiseworthy. If in our imagination we worship a God who divides humanity into righteous and unrighteous, then we have to judge people in the same way ourselves. If we worship a God who regards human beings differently according to ethnicity, or whether they be my people or not my people, we will relate to humanity around us in exactly the same xenophobic way and consider our racism as righteous. Put simply, worshipping a monster makes monsters out of us. The history of invasions, colonizations, executions, witch hunts, genocides, persecutions, slavery, Jim Crow, and law enforcement lynchings, all done in the name of God, is more than enough evidence to confirm the ugly ramifications of worshipping a violent and xenophobic deity. There is a tragic inevitability to it, that if we confuse brutal colonization with the actions of God, then we will become brutal colonizers ourselves in the name of God. This is why it is critical that we not continue to translate the stories of the destroyer as if they were stories of God. This is why we should in no way allow ourselves to confuse a dragon story with a God story. However, merely making the case for that in my books and videos has been sufficient for Christian believers around the world to believe that they are thinking in a godly way and doing God a service when they threaten me with the Almighty's eternal fiery judgment. Of course, they insist they are not judging me. No, they will leave that to the destroyer. Good for them. Of course, I'm not the first person in the world to be on the receiving end of this kind of attention. For centuries, a horrible eternity has been the stick wagged in the faces of the faithful to help motivate the people to take the carrot of salvation offered through Christian adherence. Choosing from the two options, your eternal destiny, has been the lens through which the Gospel and the New Testament have been read. My friend Pastor Lance would be one of a great number of evangelical preachers who hold a belief in which the gospel of Jesus Christ is about nothing other than the message of heaven versus hell. And if in a single sermon the preacher has not held out the threat of hell with one hand and the promise of heaven in the other, then that preacher has simply failed to preach the gospel. Seen through the polarizing lens of heaven versus hell, the gospel becomes a message of binaries. Heaven versus hell, worship versus apostasy, obedience versus sin, saved versus unsaved. Before it became a message of this kind, or at least came to be interpreted that way, I argue that the teachings of Jesus could be seen on a far more invitational and expansive canvas. For instance, the Gospel of Matthew tells us that a phrase Jesus toured with throughout his preaching campaigns was the kingdom of heaven. Heard through the traditional matrix of beliefs, the term kingdom conjures up the idea of a feudal dominion in which God is the king and everyone else exists purely to honor and obey him. Once again, by contrast, root meanings offer us a different perspective in which the Greek basileia, ton uranon, could equally be translated as the cosmic realm. It would be hard to imagine a more invitational and expansive canvas than that. Instead, all around the world in circles Orthodox, Catholic and Protestant, the eternal heaven versus hell paradigm has been believed a priori, to use Reverend Dr. Keswick's phrase, before reading a word of the Gospel and New Testament. For this reason, it might come as a shock to many believers to learn that the very concept of a conscious eternity is essentially absent from the pages of the Bible. The Hebrew word, generally translated as eternal, is olam, and the Greek word aeon translates it. However, this is a false translation. Professor Daniel Garone is one of Italy's most widely respected scholars of Biblical Hebrew and is the co-author of the Dictionary of Biblical Hebrew and Aramaic. In his pages, Professor Garone makes the very strong statement that all the great theological dictionaries concede that olam does not mean eternity and should not be translated that way. Here, I have to give credit to my comrade, Mauro Biglino, who pointed me to Professor Garone's contribution and has encouraged me to add Italian papers, dictionaries and lexicons to my already overwhelmed bookcases. Mauro explains, "The reason olam has been translated as eternal is because of its association with Yahweh, a word which has been interpreted as God. If he is God, then he must be eternal. If he is eternal, then olam must mean eternal. In other words, it is an invented translation." In fact, the words olam and aeon both carry a meaning that is quite different to the conventional translation. Their actual meaning points us down a completely different avenue to discover a long-forgotten layer of story in the pages of the Bible. Now, at this point, you might think that this is far too much theology for a book about memories of E.T. contact. You might want to say to me, "Paul, I'm actually not very interested in theology. I'm not a religious person, and eternity isn't really something I think about." And that's fine. But let me ask you this. Are you interested in the cosmos? Are you interested in the nature of the dimension that we occupy? Are you intrigued by the portals represented by the Naus carvings uncovered by Roland de Vaux and other archaeologists around the Levant? Earlier, I suggested that a Naus is what you and I would call a portal. Would you like to know if the idea of portals or stargates exists in the Bible before God? If you answered any of these questions with a yes, then the word olam will lead us into some territory that I know you will find fascinating. If I use the word dimensions, you might think I'm using language that is exclusive to the 20th and 21st centuries. Perhaps it isn't a concept you'd expect to find in ancient narratives or in the Bible. However, ancestral narratives all around the world play with the concept of dimensionality, the idea of a plane that is different to ours, somehow occupying the same space, and yet somehow beyond the realm of our knowledge and senses. In the Norse myths, there exists a dimension occupied by beings more advanced than ourselves, whom we usually don't perceive, and whose plane of existence we are mostly unaware of. Yet what happens in that dimension impacts what happens in this one. The same notes can be heard in ancient stories of the Shi. In Celtic thought, this was a parallel dimension immediately adjacent to our own, which could impact life in this dimension as we perceive it. Accordingly, the ancient saints and druids of the Celtic peoples developed mystical modalities and shamanic practices intended to tune the practitioner in to the realities of the Shi. Aboriginal Australian rituals and narratives of the dreaming carry identical concepts. So, whether we find ourselves on the southern or northern hemisphere, indigenous traditions can provide us with ancient language for what you and I would call dimensions. In the pages ahead, I'm going to show you that the word Olam in the Bible leads us ultimately into the very same territory. For instance, the Talmud uses the word Olam and translates it to mean plural worlds or universes. Think about that. What does pluralizing the word universe imply? The root of the word Olam points us to the idea of the mysterious unknown. The English language invokes similar concepts of unknowing when we talk about the great beyond. It's something we're aware of, yet it's beyond our senses, a realm beyond this world and beyond our knowing. The great unknown indicates something we don't know experientially, yet we know it's there. All those layers are there in the ancient Hebrew usage of the word Olam. Of course, words can carry different meanings in different contexts, and they can change their meaning through time. So did Olam ever have an association with time? Or is it a word that only references the unknown or the great beyond? As it happens, there are passages where Olam does carry a temporal reference. For example, in the book of the prophet Isaiah from the 8th century BCE, we read this: I have held my peace, me Olam. I have been still and restrained myself. But now, like a woman in labor, I will cry and pant and gasp. The writer says that he has held his peace, me Olam, for a time. He doesn't say how long, but the implication is for a long time now, or maybe for I don't know how long. In this instance, the mystery lies in when this period of holding his peace began. What is clear, though, is that this period, however long it has been, has now come to an end. But now I will cry and pant. In that sense, me'olam means almost the opposite of an infinite time stretching into the future. It may be an unknown time stretching into the past, but it is a finite time with a definite end. Indeed, that is the point of the whole passage. His waiting is at an end. Isaiah 32 uses the word Olam in a very similar way. The palace will be forsaken, it says. The bustling city will be deserted. The forts and towers will become lairs for animals, Olam, until the Ruach from on high comes down. Once again, we have a reference to a time whose duration is unknown. The city will be deserted for nobody knows how long, until. The writer is invoking a sense of mystery and the unknown, telling us that the duration of the curse on the city has been concealed, but at the same time reassuring the reader that the curse will end. It will not be forever. Perhaps I'm stating the obvious, But by the time I'd worked out that the Gehenna of Jesus' teaching referred not to Dante's hell, but to Jerusalem's municipal trash heap, and once I had learned that the Hebrew word olam and its Greek equivalent aeon do not point to endless time, I had concluded for myself that the church's threat of eternal hell was a teaching built on a foundation of sand. Today I'm fascinated by the direction the word olam points us, with its sense of plural worlds or universes, dimensions beyond, unfathomable mystery, and journeys into the unknown. This same sense of mystery and concealment is powerfully expressed in a passage in the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11 uses the word olam like this: "The powerful ones made everything beautiful in its time. Also, Elohim put olam in their hearts, so that without exception no one can discover the things that the powerful ones have done from beginning to end." Here, olam is a mystery that nobody can fathom. Yet our makers have wired within us a fascination for the unknown, a curiosity which has driven human inquiry and progress from time immemorial. In the 4th century before Common Era, Plato echoed this belief in his books Phaedo and Timaeus and Critias, where he makes a case that our ancestors were improved by mysterious otherworldly visitors who fine-tuned us in such a way as to heighten our capacity for intelligence and consciousness. Perhaps Plato and the writer of Ecclesiastes are recalling the same powerful ones and telling the same mysterious story of how it was we first attained our sense of wonder, mystery, and curiosity. The same sense of mystery is invoked in Genesis 21:33. "And he planted in Beersheba a tamarisk tree, and there called on the throne of Yahweh, Olam." Abraham calls on Yahweh of the beyond, or Yahweh the unknown. What does this have to do with portals and stargates? I did promise earlier on that these intriguing phenomena would make an appearance in this chapter, and you may have been wondering when they were going to show up. In my book Echoes of Eden, I take some time to probe these cosmic phenomena theorized by Einstein and Rosen early in the 20th century and investigated, measured, and flown around by NASA for more than 30 years. These stretching concepts intersect with the biblical word olam in a fascinating way in Psalm 24, a psalm which Monsignor Corrado Balducci believes is all about interstellar travel and paleocontact. If you're not familiar with Monsignor Corrado Balducci, he was a senior theological advisor to Pope Benedict XVI at the time of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences colloquium in 2009 regarding the implications of extraterrestrial contact. Monsignor Balducci's day job is as a senior Vatican advisor in paranormal ministry, entity removal, and exorcisms. In 2009, he acquired some extra duties, which involved speaking for the Pope on the question of extraterrestrial contact. In various interviews and statements, Monsignor Balducci insisted that on the basis of his personal research, people who report close encounters in the present are not describing psychotic breaks, neither are they entity attachments or demonic experiences. Close encounters are experiences of, quote, "a totally different kind of entity, and one that merits serious study." Monsignor Balducci argues that from the very first verse, which implies divine jurisdictions over life on other planets, Psalm 24 is about extraterrestrial contact. Is he right? For me, the biggest clue lies not in the first verse of the psalm, but in verse 7, which says this: "You gates, lift up your heads, and lift up, you doors, olam." In some auspicious sense, we are opening the doors to the great beyond. They are the doors to the unknown, and all is anticipation as we look to see who or what will come from the unknown dimension and arrive through these doors. Having amped up the suspense, the psalmist finally reveals it. And shall come in Melech HaKavod, the king with his kavod. Now, what in the world is one of those? Join me in the next chapter as our journey takes us from California to the war-torn country of Syria, where the things we learn about kavods and the great Olam will do more than challenge our view of the Bible. It will redefine how we understand our place in the cosmos and the real agenda of our traditional God figures on Project Earth. I hope you enjoyed that chapter from the Eden Conspiracy. I want us to follow on from that with three questions that I'd like us to explore in the thread and then in a live conversation to follow. My first question to you is, when did you first become aware of the doctrine of hell and how was it presented to you? The second question is, what was it that first made you think there's something off here, I'm not convinced? And thirdly, what is the thing more than anything else that has helped you shake the doctrine off and move away from it? So I'll look forward to comparing notes with you in the thread and in a live conversation to follow. Thank you for joining me in this module. If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. We've been told ancient texts about the gods are just myths. Close encounters and anomalous experiences are just fantasy. And ancient wisdom is just irrelevant. But what if the knowledge of our ancestors is not just a reservoir of information about the past, but a roadmap to a better and bigger human experience? Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.